The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg.
I am excited to be speaking today on the Morning Show about a really entertaining and interesting book. But on top of the quality of this book, there is also a very important and poignant backstory, which also makes this interview really important. This book is titled The Capital of Basketball, A History of D.C. Area High School Hoops, and it was written by a gifted journalist who loved the game of basketball. His name was John McNamara, and you undoubtedly maybe recognize that name because I'm so sad to say John McNamara was one of the five journalists at the Annapolis Capital Gazette who was killed in a mass shooting in June of 2018. At the time of his death, John McNamara was hard at work on this book, and it was the wish of his widow, Andrea Chambly, that this book would be finished. And indeed, she did so, undertaking that effort with a friend and a colleague of her husband's, David Elfin, and this book is completed and now before the public. And it is a marvelous examination of the vibrant landscape of basketball in the D.C. area, but also a testament to John McNamara's love of the game and devotion to sports journalism. And I'm just profoundly honored to be able to speak for the next few minutes with Andrea Chambly about the experience of completing her husband's book. Andrea Chambly, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, and thanks for your kind words.
Well, I really do appreciate this opportunity to speak with you. I wonder if you could say a word about the partnership that you and your husband had. I mean, you yourself have had a vibrant and demanding professional life as an attorney, but you found the time to also be, from the sounds of it, a very meaningful part of your husband's work as a sports writer. Tell us about that.
Well, thank you. He never liked my reading his work before it was finished. So he would go into his den after a long day at the office and covering a game and continue his work on this book. He would schedule interviews and call people on the phone. He would take them out to dinner or for coffee. He would go to the several great libraries around here in Alexandria and D.C. and Maryland and get the photos that he wanted and come home with a satchel full of microfiche pages that he had copied at the libraries. And then he would go into his den and work on the book. And my role at that time was to bring him dinner at his desk. And every once in a while, I'd remind him to back up his files. And so I knew where they were. And when he died, I couldn't go in his den for weeks until finally I went in there and I saw a to-do list for the book taped above his desk and I saw the boxes of files and I just knew I had to finish it.
I wonder if you would tell our listeners the story of someone by the name of Bob Dwyer, because in some respects, his death back in 2007 was something of a impetus, a galvanizing force for your husband to set to work on this book. Explain to our listeners who Bob Dwyer was and what it was about his death that played a role in this book beginning to take shape?
I'd love to. Bob Dwyer was a wonderful coach and mentor to high school students and other coaches. He coached at Archbishop Carroll for the Lions. He had a 55-game winning streak and multiple championships. And he died in 2007. And John had been writing this book in his head for years by that time, but not on paper. And when he died, he said, well, I guess that's it. I can't write the book without new quotes from Bob Dwyer. And I said, no, this means you have to start writing the book to get quotes from everybody else out there. And they can tell you about Bob Dwyer, and you can write about them, too. And you need to get started. His note says, I called them old-timers, and I can't for the life of me remember calling these esteemed basketball legends old-timers. Perhaps I did, but I did tell him that he had to get going, and that's when he really started working on this another 8 hours a day at the end of his workday.
Wow. Your husband covered all kinds of sports, but clearly basketball was his first love. What was it about the game of basketball that he especially loved?
Well, he was just as knowledgeable about baseball. In fact, I'll never forget when Bryce Harper left the Nationals, he said, we can still win a championship with Juan Soto. Don't worry. So he knew his basketball and his baseball. But the thing about high school basketball is you can sit just an arm's length away from these talented high school players, and the caliber of play is just jaw-droppingly wonderful, and the coaches here work on the players to play as a real team on and off the court to turn them into good citizens and good students and good players. There's really a culture of developing all around good citizens here in Washington, D.C. And I credit the black schools who started getting coaches who had graduated from Howard University and couldn't get drafted and couldn't coach in the pros, and they turned to develop great citizens in their neighborhood. And that culture just survives here in Washington and makes it very special.
Hmm. We're speaking with Andrea Chambly, and we are talking about the book The Capital of Basketball, A History of D.C. Area High School Hoops, a book which her husband began work on and was working on diligently over the course of 10 years, perhaps more. And after his tragic death, one of five journalists killed in the mass shooting at the Annapolis Capital Gazette, Andrea Chambly, with the help of a good friend, managed to complete this book, which has now been published by Georgetown University Press. Andre Chambly, you've already touched on the fact that you, after a few days, maybe a week's, had elapsed since your husband's death, that you finally found the courage to go into his den. Were you going into the den specifically to look for this material, or just was it in a sense more of a general visit to that place that was so important to him, that room? And I guess part of what I'm asking is, how surprised were you to find all that you found there in terms of this book?
Well, John was one of seven children, and he asked me to respect his den as his quiet place that he hadn't had growing up and his place to write. So I was happy to do that for him. And for a couple of weeks after he died, I kept the door closed, and I just shuddered when I walked by. But I had his ashes in this beautiful urn in Maryland colors, it happened to be, although I didn't think of that when I got it. And I had to put it somewhere. And I thought I would put it in his den for now and on the top of his bookshelf. So I went in there with his ashes and found a place for it. And in front of his desk, I saw these three file boxes with files by school and by year from 1900 to 1998. And he wanted to get up to 2,000 when Morgan Wooten was inducted into the Hall of Fame. So I looked at the files and I saw just how beautifully they were organized. And I saw the one little place that was incomplete. So I looked through them and I found the backup files and I called David Elfin. And he not only covered the last 2 years, but he looked through the whole thing and if there was a first name missing or a team nickname missing, he knew how to fix all those little gaps. And he just turned it into the final product. And I'm really grateful.
How much had your husband managed to write? Or was it more that the materials were gathered and maybe an outline drawn up? I mean, had he managed to begin the process of actually writing the book?
Yes, it was on the brink of completion. He had already written out the full chapters for 1950 to 1998. And he wanted to start in 1900 when the game came to Washington from Springfield, Massachusetts. And he had a really detailed outline noting when he wanted to use a quote. And then attached to that page, he had the copy of the microfiche with the quote in orange highlighter. So I really just had to assemble it. I didn't have to write it. So for 1900 to 1950, I assembled it from his outline and his attachments, and then it was finished.
One of the stories I have read about is that among the materials that your husband left behind was a huge treasure trove of photos, I think 178, none of them with captions. And the first time I read that, it didn't really hit me just what that meant. But then I started thinking about 178 photos and none of them having captions. And of course, they didn't have captions because your husband knew at a glance what all of these photos were. That's how thoroughly he understood this whole landscape and culture. But what a task for you and David Elfin to try to make sense of these photos in order to include them in the book.
Yeah, I put them in a folder. Some of them were on his computer, and a lot of them had been obtained from the libraries. And I put them all together in a photo, and I started carrying them around with me. And whenever I saw David Elfin, I would ask him who they were. And there's another sports writer who wrote a book, Josh Barr, invited me over to his house and looked through them. And then I ended up at Morgan Wooten's house in his living room, and he's looking through them and telling me who they were, although nobody could tell me, for example, what game it was necessarily. Oh, this is the 1956 game of Springarn versus DeMatha, for example, and that player had 23 points in that game and 10 rebounds. Morgan Wooten was pretty close with all that, but I had to end up, once I knew who the players were and what school it was, I could go to the library that has all the yearbooks and look at their yearbook and find the picture that had the cut line. So with the government shutdown, you know, we're not allowed to work anywhere else during the shutdown. So I had nothing to do for 6 weeks but go back to the library and find each picture's caption.
Wow. That is a labor of love. I understand that your husband conducted some 150 interviews or more, that is extraordinary as well. In what form did those interviews survive? Were those interviews in which he had taken notes or made recordings?
Well, he was an old school hand note journalist. He did use recordings when he had to, say at a press conference after a football game, but for interviews he liked handwritten notes, and then he would come home and type them up. So I had the combination of the handwritten notes and what he typed up. But at that point, he had put all his interviews in the chapter already, But I did check and make sure they were, you know, he wasn't quoting an old interview and that it was his own interview. But he didn't have that for the players from 1900 to 1950. But but those I found out there weren't, it wasn't able to get those and this year. So, but they were all incorporated into the book by then. He was really on the brink of finishing it.
Right. The book is interesting in that it includes some great basketball luminaries and names that would be familiar to just about anybody who's a true student of the game. But there are also some names here that will not be well known to the general public at all, and yet men whose stories are really important, such as one E.B. Henderson. Explain to our listeners why the name E.B. Henderson is important in the capital of basketball.
Well, he's one of my favorite characters in this story and one of my favorite people in American history now. He went up to Springfield, Massachusetts and met with Dr. Naismith. Dr. Naismith's game was a nine-man game at that point. It was three on offense, three on defense, and three, I guess, in the middle. And it was a passing-only game. And there was a circus performer in D.C. Who brought this to the gentlemen in the armory to keep them in shape during the winter months. And E.B. Henderson brought this to the African-American schools for the same reason. And they turned it into a five-man running game with passing. And D.C. was the first home of the fast break, pugnacious defense, hard-hitting basketball schools. And, in fact, they used to play surrounded by chain-link fences, and they were called cagers. And that was to keep the audience out, but it also was so that the defense could throw the player with the ball against the chain-link fence and get the ball jarred loose. Mm-hmm. And we also had one of the first referees in D.C., and you can see why we needed that, too. But E.B. Henderson changed the game. He got his team adopted by Howard University, and they became the official Howard team. And then he went on to strive to desegregate the game, and he probably wrote 3,000 letters and essays and a great book called The Negro in Sports. And he ended up founding the first chapter of the NAACP. And so he wasn't just a sports hero. He was a civil rights hero, and he never stopped his tireless work for integration and so that black kids and white kids could play each other together.
Hmm. That story in and of itself makes it worth it to take this book in hand. We've already mentioned the name of Morgan Wooten, and I think it's important to say a further word about just what an incredible coach he was at the high school level, maybe one of the best high school coaches of all time in any sport. Just explain to our listeners what a towering figure he is, and also the connection that your own father, John Mack, your own husband had with him.
Sure. Well, the book ends with Morgan Wooten's induction into the Hall of Fame as the first high school coach inducted into the Hall of Fame. He's expected to be a teacher. He ended up working for Coach Joe Gallagher at St. John's, and that was where my husband went to school. Joe Gallagher had great teams, and my husband pretended that he got over not making the team, but I'm not sure he ever did. Morgan coached for Joe Gallagher for about 2 years, and then he was recognized as a great potential, and DeMatha hired Morgan. He thought he was being hired as a teacher, and he still loves to teach, and he was teaching when he got hired. But he became an institution in D.C. for developing such a wonderful program at DeMatha with so many NBA players. James Brown is a perfect example of a remarkable scholar, athlete, Brown turned down offers to go to Division I and went to Harvard instead, and obviously never left sports because he's on CBS football now. Morgan is such a generous, wonderful man. His son Joe is named for Joe Gallagher, and they always remained friends.
Mm-hmm. And Morgan Wooten is the coach at DeMatha for 46 years. His win-loss record, 1,274 wins to 192 losses. I mean, just an extraordinary legacy. And beyond the numbers, of course, just the all of the young players, young athletes whom he profoundly affected. And, of course, there are great basketball players in this book as well, including the story of someone whose name I am embarrassed to say I did not know, one Earl Lloyd, the first African-American to play in the NBA, beginning in 1950, so not long after Jackie Robinson broke into Major League Baseball.
Yes, and what's remarkable about basketball is that kids were playing each other on the streets for years, whether they were black or white. I mean, the adults were able to keep black players off the football fields and golf courses and tennis courts, but they couldn't stop kids from playing basketball together. So when finally an African-American had a chance to step on the court in the NBA with white players, it didn't create as much of the blowback as it did in other sports like baseball.
A great story. And, of course, some towering legends in NBA history are part of this book as well, including probably most notably Elgin Baylor and Dave Bing, two of the best players to ever play in the NBA, and both coming from the same high school in the Washington, D.C. area.
I think that's the most productive basketball high school, Springarn, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
That school produced some remarkable human beings. I mean, not just players, but remarkable human beings. Hmm. And that's what I like about this story. I love basketball. I covered it when I went to high school for my county paper. And in my county, the caliber wasn't quite so high as it is in the other nearby counties in Maryland and D.C. But I love the sport, but I also love the history of the contributions these people made on and off the court.
Hmm. So this book, your husband's final book, was completed with, again, the help of David Elfin, has now been published and so on. I have read a number of articles about you and interviews done with you in which you have said on more than one occasion essentially the words, there is no such thing as closure. I mean, one might speak about closure, but when somebody suffers this kind of a devastating loss, there just isn't anything like at least complete and full disclosure. What does this book represent for you? Is it, in a sense, a hint of closure, or does it represent something else for you?
Well, I think closure is something that people who love you hope that you achieve. But so far, I can't say I expect that to happen. But John was such a devoted friend and husband, and I would tell him that I feel like I'm so far behind in keeping up with his gestures of love. And he would scrape my car off when there was ice on it in the winter. He would make my coffee, even though he never touched the stuff. He was always there when I needed it, when I needed him. And he didn't need as much as I did. And I told him I was falling behind, and he said I wasn't. But I never quite believed him until I got this book out, and I thought maybe I'm not behind after all. I know he wanted to be remembered as a sports writer. He wouldn't have wanted to be remembered for how he died. He would want to be remembered for how much he loved basketball. Mm. And he would want other people to love it too when they heard the stories.
Right. And especially all of the stories of perseverance, of triumph over injustice that illuminate the pictures of this really wonderful book. Once again, it's titled The Capital of Basketball, A History of D.C. Area High School Hoops, published by Georgetown University Press. The book first and foremost by John McNamara, but finished by his friend and colleague David Elfin and by his wife, Andrea Chambly. Andrea Chambly, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. I applaud your good efforts to complete your husband's wonderful book, and I wish you well in the years ahead. And I thank you again for being part of The Morning Show today. Best wishes.
Thank you so much.
The time is 8:35, and you are listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's program is from The Morning Show archives. Talk today about remaining young. And the topic is of great importance to just about all of us in various ways. And it is explored in most intriguing fashion in a brand new book called You, Staying Young, The Owner's Manual for Looking Good and Feeling Great. The book is co-authored by two doctors, Mehmet C. Oz, Dr. Oz, who is well known for his work on television, and one of his friends and colleagues, my morning show guest today, Dr. Michael F. Roizen, who is a best-selling author and co-founder of a popular website called RealAge.com. He is chief wellness officer and chair of the Wellness Institute of the Cleveland Clinic, and he is the chief medical consultant to the Dr. Oz Show. And this book, published by Simon & Schuster, is just the latest in several collaborations between these two well-known and highly regarded doctors. Again, this newest book called You, Staying Young, The Owner's Manual for Looking Good and Feeling Great. Dr. Michael Roizen, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
It's a privilege to be here. Thank you very much.
I'm excited to talk with you. And
Greg, the excitement is mine, so thank you.
The book really sets this whole topic in very healthy context, I think. That is, it's a good way for us to be thinking about this, and it brings into question some of the assumptions which a lot of us make. And one of them is this, that living longer is not the point. And, of course, you very carefully titled the book Staying Young. But at one point in the introduction, you say living longer should not be about taking longer to die. It should be about enjoying every moment of a longer life and taking longer to live. Obviously, that's a distinction that is very, very important to you and your co-author.
That's exactly right. The point of this is, if you will, the idea behind it is that you can live vibrantly till real near the end and then essentially get struck by lightning and die. And that's what most of us want to do, that is to live vibrantly and without frailty. And that's really a key. So if we eliminated all heart disease and all cancer, we might live 8 years longer. But if we eliminated frailty, you'd live 60 or 70 years longer. And that's and with vibrancy. And that's really the key, is how do you eliminate that frailty, and what do you do, and how easy is it to do it? So there are a lot of what we do, I mean, where there's science in the book, there's also a lot of action steps so people can understand both the science and then know what to do. And there's pretty easy things, what to do to change your rate of aging so that you stay vibrant. Now, one of the key points in science is you develop defects in yourself, in your cells, threefold greater every 10 years. So if you decrease your rate of aging by 10 years, you're essentially got threefold less defects in your cells. If you do it by 20 years, you got tenfold, three times three, so you get ninefold less errors. And so the key is slowing aging just by 20 years means that you are much more vibrant, much less likely to be frail as you do get older in calendar years.
One of the most surprising moments in the book, I think, but also a moment which is potentially of great help in helping us think about this, in a sense, more holistically, is when you and Dr. Oz liken the human body to a city. Why is it helpful for us to think about our human body, our own body, and our sort of own personal physical health as something like a city? In what way is that model helpful and beneficial?
Well, the analogy lets people understand what it is. So you're, and let me give you some of the ideas. So a city can become old. Some of the European cities have become old and inelegant, whereas some cities that are old rejuvenate themselves, repair themselves, redesign themselves, such as Paris, and it's gorgeous, it's beautiful. And the analogy works in another way. San Francisco is built on earthquake faults. That's its genes, if you will. But whether it has a crisis for every sixth earthquake or not depends on what the citizens have done, what the regulations are, how they've treated their city so that it doesn't have every piece of building falls apart. They've learned how to build with architecture that can withstand sixes and maybe even sevens and maybe even eights of earthquakes. So the geography is your genes, but you get to change them. You get to know whether they will be affected or not by the way you act, by the way you make choices that influence your genes.
Hmm. That's a really fascinating insight which you offer, that because I think most of us think of our genetic makeup and our genetic predisposition as something entirely out of our own control. But you contend that there are actually steps that people can take, and probably as medical science continues to advance, there's going to be more and more which we can even do about our own health, even at that level of genetic predisposition, which is really an amazing thing to think about.
Yeah, the real key, you know, probably the most important study that has been done since 2000, since we were able to characterize that we have a genome and what it is one that you get to take action steps for and that we talk about in the book, which is the ENCODE study. And you don't have to remember the name at all. But what we know is that about 10 to 20% of your total DNA is genes. And so what people thought the other 80 to 90% was junk. They called it junk DNA. But it isn't junk. It switches, and that's what the ENCODE study group found. It is switches that control your genes. So all your genes do is they're protein factories. But whether that factory is on or not is controlled by these switches. And it turns out your actions and your choices to a huge degree control those 22 to 30,000 genes by either turning them on or off. And let me give you a specific example. When you are stressed, you turn on 548, we don't know the exact number, you make them active producing proteins when you're stressed, genes that produce things that cause inflammation in your body. So there are 548 different proteins that are released when you get stressed. But if you manage that response so you aren't stressed, so the same event occurs, but now you have managed it so you don't get a stress response to it, none of those genes turns on. So you don't have the inflammation in your body. So you get to control, you literally get to control what's going on in your body.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Michael Roizen, and we are talking about the book which he has co-authored with Dr. Mehmet Oz, You, Staying Young, The Owner's Manual for Looking Good and Feeling Great. Before we get into a few of the specifics in terms of how this book is put together, I certainly want you to have a chance to talk through the principles of longevity, which are part of the introduction, which I think are so helpful for anybody who wants to kind of think about the whole notion of what well-being is all about and what a long life at its best really entails. Explain, first of all, about how the process of aging, which of course is in an inevitable process, is involved in a whole lot of trade-offs. And what kind of good trade-offs do we need to be prepared to make?
Well, so we think of, if you will, aging as, if you will, creaky joints and constipation and bowels that don't work, et cetera. And you live to 80-something, and then in exchange you're going to have your fair share of misery. Well, that isn't the right trade-off. The right trade-off is, in fact, the reason that we get to over 30 and then develop problems is all our genes care about is that we reproduce. And we reproduce usually and largely and have for all of our history before the age of 30. So what makes sense for reproduction doesn't necessarily make sense for longevity. So, for example, when you go in a famine, you shut down your reproductive cells so that you don't produce a child during a time when they couldn't get the right nourishment. Makes total sense for this. You're shutting down processes. But when you go in a famine and you're old, as we talked about with calorie restriction, you in fact get to kill cells that are not going to survive. And when you're doing the refeeding, you actually produce more stem cells that then can repair damage. So the trade-off, what doesn't make sense for reproduction makes perfect sense for old age and vice versa.
Hmm.
And so those are the trade-offs that we talk about. Aging isn't some master plan for your life, but rather an offshoot of perpetuation of the species.
Right. And of course, you've just touched on your second principle, which is that the aging process is not so much about things breaking down as what is your body's capacity to repair, to recover? And, of course, we can do all kinds of things to enhance that. Let's talk about the third principle, which is where you say aging happens from both the inside out and the outside in. I'm so glad you said this because I think you're absolutely right that most of us think of aging as a somewhat sort of mysterious process, even though it's something we all experience, but that it's something completely sort of intangible and not within our grasp to even understand, let alone affect. Tell us more about this model of inside out and outside in, why this is important.
It goes with what we were talking about, the question you asked before, Greg, that was so insightful, which was that you get to control it. So it is simple things like putting on sunblock protects you from the outside. But in addition, your arteries, which nourish your skin, are from the inside of you, and they, by nourishing your skin, prevent wrinkles, so you don't look that way. But in the bigger sense of the word, it is really about your rate of aging. So we double our rate of aging, as I said, about every 7.5 to 8 years, or we have threefold as many errors 10 years from now as we have now. Well, if you can stop that, if you can slow that by 20 years over your lifetime, which is really quite doable, you actually at age 80 function like you're 60 or with much less frailty. And so the goal, in fact, is to keep extending that. And so all of these areas, there are the 14 areas in here, which we talk about where there's really enormous research into mechanism to slow that. All of this is, in fact, relating to the repair mechanisms and being able to send in new stem cells, which will repair the damage and replace it with new cells. So if you have a heart attack, rather than that part of the heart dying and there'd be no retrieve and you just don't function very well and don't pump blood very well, In fact, you send in new stem cells, which replace the old cells, and you come back to pumping your blood normally and having the energy and vitality of someone who didn't have any damage in the first place.
Hmm. I appreciate that your fourth principle touches on what is such a frustrating reality for a lot of people who are aging, namely the fact that it is so often a compounding of problems, one problem that affects another problem, that aggravates another problem, that sets all kinds of things in motion, and the fact that even treating a given problem will sometimes aggravate another problem or create one that didn't exist. And it's important for us to understand this, because this is also a reality which, at least to an extent, we can prevent.
Right. So people often call this the Swiss cheese theory of aging, or the Swiss cheese effects. So if you line up all the holes in Swiss cheese, that's when you get aging. But if, as long as they're in random order and you can't get through with errors, then you don't develop the aging phenomenon. So the goal is to have more of these layers of protection, more of the slices of Swiss cheese that don't allow the errors to come through, so that the healthier you are, the more you do physical activity that is appropriate for those four components, 10,000 steps a day, 20 minutes of resistance training twice a week, jumping 40 times a day, and doing a little cardio 20 minutes three times a week. As long as you do that, you're much more protected against other injuries from bad food, or against inflammatory processes, or against other causes of injury. So, and the same thing, in other words, if you do the right stress practices, if you avoid toxins, if you do the right physical activity practices, if you choose foods that are anti-inflammatory, all of those things prevent the next layer of going down, so you avoid hitting the holes in the Swiss cheese, or you keep healthier longer.
Hmm. And the final of these five principles is sort of the summation of all that we've talked about thus far. Aging is reversible. That is, even if you are looking back at certain choices you've made that were not the right choices when it comes to physical well-being, that it is never too late to, at least to some extent, halt that decline and maybe reverse the process of aging at least a bit.
That's exactly right, Greg. So we routinely take people who have type 2 diabetes and get them to reverse it. So there's 60 to 70% of us have the genes for type 2 diabetes. And whether we develop it is often brought on by environmental factors such as how we eat and exercise, et cetera. Well, just as easily as we can bring it on, we can reverse it. Same goes for high blood pressure. Same goes for plaque in our arteries. You get to pull it out if you want to. And that's really one of the keys. Aging may be inevitable, but the rate of aging isn't, and you get to reverse it if you want. All you need is that nudge to do so and to actually take action.
Speaking of that, let's talk about some of the important components that are that form the framework of this book. Again, we're talking about You, Staying Young, and I'm speaking with its co-author, Michael Roizen, Dr. Roizen. In just about every chapter, one of the features is major agers. And I guess this is where we look at factors in our lives that are contributing to the aging process.
That's right. The way we organized the book was to have a major ager and then to talk about some of the ways you can deal with those. So, for example, when we talk about toxins, we talk about canceling out cancer and also breathing easy. Breathing easy obviously involves how you avoid the toxins in the air, and cancel out cancer is the toxins that you might get in food or other places. Another major ager is glycosylation, putting an excess glucose on your oxygen, and then we talk about how you can avoid, if you will, the complications of type 2 diabetes. So all of these, there are 14 major agers where there are major research now going into the aging processes, and if we have any a breakthrough in any of these 14, you will be able to live to be 160 with a quality of life of 45. And as I said, we're on our way, especially in this periodic fast, to maybe getting a key insight into how we can do that. As you know, the jellyfish lives forever by, when it gets enough injury, it goes back and just starts all over again, regenerating itself from its own stem cells. Well, we know that if we keep enough stem cells, we can repair any injury. And so that's really a key. So you get a muscle injury, you send in your stem cells, which repair it and become muscle cells. You get a heart attack, if you've got enough stem cells, they go in there and repair that and become those heart muscle cells. So we know that the key is close to a breakthrough, and that periodic fast of 5 days where you both turn on sirtuin, which helps slow your rate of aging, but you also turn on your stem cell production and your telomeres and your stem cells, so you regenerate stem cells with that. So anyway, what we do is we go through the 14 areas, the latest research, and then all the steps that we know that you can take now that make a difference in your rate of aging now until that major breakthrough occurs. Now, you can say, well, what's the chance of a major breakthrough? Well, Google, the lead scientist at Google, is now working hard on human longevity. That's where they've put him, and he believes that it's more likely than not by 2030 we will have a breakthrough. Now, who is he? It's Ray Kurzweil, who is the guy who predicted to the day when the big blue IBM computer would beat the chess champion Kasparov. And he's the guy who's worked a lot on Moore's Law and on the change in adoption of solar panels, et cetera. But he's had a tremendous series of correct predictions, and he says there's enough interest and investment in aging research that one of these areas is likely to be have a major breakthrough by 2030.
Hmm.
So it's imperative, or it's beneficial for you if you're going to live past 2030. You might as well be as young as you can be at 2030, so you can stay that way for the rest of your life when that major breakthrough occurs.
A lot of intriguing information here, and every chapter also giving us tests we can take to sort of assess our own process of aging, tips on what to do better, tools to work towards our own well-being. A most valuable book, again, called You Staying Young, The Owner's Manual for Looking Good and Feeling Great, published by Scribner, a division of Simon & Schuster. And Dr. Michael Roizen, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. It was great to talk to you.
You're wonderful. Thank you. Great question.
Tomorrow's morning show may possibly be preempted by NPR's coverage of the impeachment hearings in Washington, D.C. If the morning show is not preempted, you'll be hearing my conversation with Cornelius Bond, the author of a book about T. Rowe Price, the man, the company, and the investment philosophy. Quite an interesting story. On Thursday, Nan Calvert pays her monthly visit to the program with an interview about the environment. With her will be Dave Giordano from Root Pike Wind, the Root Pike Watershed Initiative. On Friday, and again, there is the possibility of Friday's program being canceled because of the impeachment hearings. If it is not, from the archives, we'll be hearing my conversation with ABC journalist Jim Murray and his memoir called The Last Day of My Life. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org and also available as a podcast. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg and hear The Morning Show 7 days a week. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College,
home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire.